Well, it's a great delight to be here again. As my lovely friend was so graciously driving me here this morning, I was looking around at all these different places, and I got to talk more slowly. And I realized that living in London is one of my fantasy lives, because I was looking at all these different places and thinking, I could live there. Ooh, wouldn't it be nice to live there? So I'm with you all a lot of the time in my fantasies, which is pretty great. And it's a great delight to be with London Insight again. It's been, I think, 2 years. I was here last year, but that was because my goddaughter's family wanted to do like an extended family trip, so we came to England. But last time I was teaching here was 2 years ago, in this very room, I believe, and just to see and hear how much London Insight has grown and the role it's playing in so many people's lives is a tremendous thing. It's a great delight, really, to witness. So how many of you are at a London Insight program for the first time? Ooh, okay. So I'm sure there's some information about ongoing programs and things you might check out. How many of you are new to meditation practice? Okay, great. So even as the topic of the day, of the days really, since I'll be here again tomorrow with some of you, though not all of you, and tomorrow is functioning as a standalone day, even though the topic is compassion, I also want to weave through this kind of foundations of meditation practice and a good chunk of how to, which will be a repetition for many of you, but as we know, sometimes it's good to hear the same stuff again and again and again. I say as a student of many meditation teachers. One of my teachers is a Burmese monk named Sayadaw Upandita. Sayadaw, as you might know, just means teacher. And I have a retreat center that I co-founded in the United States, which you also may know, the Insight Meditation Society. And we brought Sayadaw Upandita it's in Barre, Massachusetts, a little town is named Barre. We brought Sayadaw Upandita to Barre in 1984, never having met him before, but we invited him to teach a three-month retreat, which I and many people sat under his guidance. And that's kind of intense, don't you think, to sit with somebody in that way, never having met them for 3 months. And it turned out that Sayadaw Upandita was and is, he may have mellowed out now, but he was an extremely intense, demanding, fierce teacher. We had a wonderful connection, but every once in a while I would think, what did we do? You know, this is really intense. And the format of the days was that we would see him six mornings a week, each of us individually, for very brief meetings to discuss our practice, which for some reason, known to nobody, those meetings are called interviews. So we would meet him 6 mornings a week, each of us, for these individual interviews. He also had a kind of teaching style where he would tend to say the same thing over and over and over again until something shifted inside of you, and then he would go on to something else. So we went through a whole period where by the time he came, I had been practicing quite ardently and devotedly for just about 14 years. And we went through this whole period, he and I together, where I'd go into his room and I would describe what was happening in my meditation practice. And he would look at me and he would say, well, in the beginning it can be like that. And I'd think, I'm not a beginner. But that was it. That was my interview. That was all he said. And I left, and I'd come back in the next day, and maybe describe something completely different. And he would look at me and he would say, well, in the beginning it can be like that. And I'd say, I'm not a beginner. And that's it. And I'd leave. And the next day, and the next day, is all he said for a long time. Well, in the beginning it can be like that. At one point, I felt like I had a giant neon 14 in my brain, like flashing out. I've been practicing for 14 years. I'm not a beginner. And then one day, something did shift inside of me, and I realized, oh, right, it's good to be a beginner, right? You know that whole thing about beginner's mind, where sometimes we get to be a little bit of an expert at something, and we close down, we shut down, we get jaded, we get complacent. We feel like, oh, I know what's coming next, you know, this leads to that, or a little bit maybe disdainful, like, what's that still doing here? You know, I've been practicing for so long. And we can lose that tremendous openness and presence and immediacy that we have when we're just starting something and we're so interested and we don't have all those assumptions and conclusions. And I thought, oh, right. It's good to be a beginner. He's not insulting me. This is a good thing. So, of course, the day that I got it, I went in to see him, and he went on to something else, which he said over and over and over again, until something shifted inside of me. So, in a way, we're all here as beginners, in a good way. That would be the best thing of all. So, I often describe meditation as a skills training. That's how I learned it. Not really so much as a tied to a belief system, certainly not tied to a dogma or even a particular philosophy. It's a skills training to be able to discover some pretty profound truths on our own, for ourselves. There's a big emphasis in the Buddhist tradition, which is the cradle within which I encounter these teachings. There's a big emphasis on what they call self-witness truth, not borrowing understanding from anybody. And I just considered that a breathtaking assessment of human possibility. Now, rather than saying, well, you know, there are a couple of people who can really understand life, and the rest of you have to sort of slavishly follow us, follow our lead, or, you know, maybe next life, or next gender, or whatever it is. That everybody, without exception, is said to have great potential. That is never, ever destroyed. We're all said to have a capacity for understanding our lives, not just living mechanically, for love, for compassion, for wisdom, for connection. No matter who we are, what we've gone through, what we might yet go through, everybody is said to have this potential, this capacity. It may be, and certainly it is often covered over, hidden from view, hard to find, hard to trust, but it's there, always. And this is the basis upon which we practice meditation. The word that we translate into meditation, the word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is bhavana, B-H-A-V-A-N-A. It means cultivation. Like cultivating the ground. So here was the Buddha in a very agrarian society using imagery that made sense. So it's cultivating the ground so that what we want, what we yearn for, what we long for can emerge. We're creating the conditions for compassion to emerge, wisdom to emerge. And this is in contrast to what might be maybe our more perhaps more acquisitive, grabby kind of mentality, like, well, if I have a big insight before lunch, I don't have to come back in the afternoon. and I can just spend the afternoon calling everybody and telling them about my insight. You know, that's more common to us. It's just the way we're conditioned. So it's a different spirit. We're just going to be cultivating the ground. We're creating the conditions for what we want to emerge. I think sometimes my friend, my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, who tells this story about, I think he was about 9 years old, and he was growing his first, and I believe his only garden. And he said he'd get so impatient when the little green fluffy stuff would start coming up on top of the carrots that he'd pull them up to help them grow faster. So he didn't have much of a harvest, which I think is perhaps why it was his only garden. So we're used to that kind of impatience, but we're going to cultivate the ground to create the conditions for what we want to emerge. In Tibetan Buddhist teaching, there's another way the word bhavana is sometimes described, although literally, even from Tibetan, it means cultivation. But sometimes, when we say meditation, what they are saying is getting used to it. Getting used to it. Getting familiarized with it. So that, of course, brings up the question, well, what's it? And this seems based on going back to that capacity it is said we all have without exception. This is based on a belief that that capacity has come alive for us. We've had moments, very likely, of quite profound connection and love and compassion and belonging and understanding. We've had these moments. So many things bring us to that kind of moment. Love, inspiration, suffering sometimes, community, music, poetry, so many things just open us and that capacity sparks and comes alive. But we don't tend to be awfully used to it. Now, so maybe we have some kind of moment and then we think, what was that? Or, I don't think I'll tell anyone about that. Or, I think I'll tell everyone about that. Or, how do I get that back? I don't know how. We don't necessarily live in the deepest places we have known. And so we meditate to get used to it, not to attain or acquire something that's so kind of unthinkable or beyond our reach. It's not like that. We've been there. But usually, so briefly, so intermittently, we don't know how to live there. And this is why we practice meditation. So here, too, it's a very different spirit than thinking, oh, man, you know, if I try for 40 years, maybe, you know, I'll have a moment of mindfulness or something like that. Very different than that. So meditation, you know, clearly, I went to India when I was 18, which was a long time ago now, much to my surprise. It's really interesting. So far going into all these places in England and asking for a ticket for someone over 60 and no one saying, you're joking. Come on. All right. So, I was 18 a good long time ago. And because the context in which I encountered these teachings was within the Buddhist tradition, these methods, these practices, clearly that way of expression and languaging comes very readily to me. So that's how I describe things, but again, you know, the methods, the style, the practices really don't entail becoming a Buddhist. There are lots of ways of expressing these things. I think these are really universal truths. So, within the Buddhist tradition, when we talk about meditation as a skills training, it's really in three great skills. One is concentration, learning how to take what could be our very flickering attention and making it more steady, more steadfast, more settled, more centered. We'll talk a lot more about that. One skill is mindfulness, the word of the hour, which, you know, I've not only been meditating for over 40 years, I've been teaching for almost 40 years, which is also quite a big surprise to me, as the years go by, they just go by. And back in the day, so when I first came back from India to the States, it was 1974, and I'd be at a party or some social situation, and somebody would say to me, "What do you do?" And I'd say, "I teach meditation." And very commonly, they would kind of go, "Oh," and sort of sidle away, like, "That's weird." And nowadays, the single most common response I get when I say I teach meditation is, "I'm so stressed out, I could use some of that." Although my favorite response, which I also hear, is, "My partner should really meet you." I do think of that. And I also hear, by the way, "Oh, I tried that once, I failed at it," which we're going to talk about a lot today. You can't fail at it. But we have many notions of what should be happening. And so we feel very distressed because those notions aren't actually real. So there has been just a kind of revolution in consciousness in terms of meditation, mindfulness, and so on. The first time I ever heard out of context the word mindfulness used, I was just thrilled. I was on the train going from New York City to Washington, D.C., and the conductors make announcements at every station, and so once and occasionally since, it's, "Please be mindful of the gap between the train and the station platform." And I got so excited. I thought, wow, they said mindful. Of course, the next conductor said what the first actually meant, which was, "Please be careful of the gap between the train and the station platform." And the last time I was on a train, which was just a few weeks ago, going from New York City to Washington, D.C., the conductor simply said, "There's a gap." There's a gap between the train and the station platform. No hint about how to relate to it. Don't fall in it. There's a gap. Okay. There's a gap. But, you know, to see what's happening with the concept of mindfulness and maybe most especially in this country, actually, it's extraordinary. It's really a fantastic thing. Classically, we talk about mindfulness as a quality of awareness where our perception of what's happening in the moment is not so affected by bias, old fears, projection into the future, comparison to what we think should be happening, all kinds of ways we might relate to our experience that just distorts it, makes it off. We feel some physical pain or some heartache, and right away we start thinking, "Oh, this is never going to change. This is how it is for the rest of my life. You know, what's it going to be like next week? What's it going to be like next month? What's it going to be like next year?" And so what we're doing is taking the present moment's worth of difficulty and adding all of this other stuff on top of it, making it that much worse. There's so many things we, just through force of habit, we tend to add on to the moment. Or we're so distracted. It's not just with pain. We're distracted by all kinds of things. With great pleasure and joy and so many happy things that might come our way. First of all, we might not even notice them because our attention might be all over the place. Or we might feel kind of undeserving and shouldn't be that way and we need to apologize for it. Last December, I went to Maui, an island in the Hawaiian Islands, And it was December, right off the east coast of the United States, snowing. So I went to Maui to co-lead this retreat with old friends Ram Dass and Krishna Dass. And Maui is like, it's like paradise on earth. It's just gorgeous. And the resort that they had rented for the retreat was just beautiful. It's right on the beach. The dining room opens up right to the ocean. It's just like this amazing place. And it was a retreat, so it was on my schedule, but something like Twitter or Facebook or Foursquare, obviously someone didn't just decide to announce us on Maui, but somebody said something on one of those social media things about my being on Maui. So right away I started getting all these emails and all these comments like, wow, you're on Maui. And I found myself writing back immediately, it's very humid here. Really, it's terribly humid. You know, basically, it's not as beautiful as you think. You know, I can't be having that good a time. Which was very funny, and of course I saw what I was doing, and it was very amusing, and I mentioned it in a talk in the hall, and it became like a theme of the retreat. These two people were walking out of the meditation hall once, just behind me, and one was a friend, the other was the son of a friend, now adult son of a friend, and he was saying, oh, you know, my mom really wanted to come, and she talked about coming, and she was really close to coming, and right at the last minute, she decided she couldn't do it, and without missing a beat, my friend said, did you tell her how humid it is here? It's really terrible. It was humid, but... You know, there's so many ways that we just out of habit might relate to pleasure and joy that really doesn't allow us to experience them so fully and completely. So mindfulness helps us clear away and see through the many habits that may arise. And with pain, certainly we may distort it, and the tremendous number of add-ons that we tend to put on top of the painful experience, whether it's physical or emotional. This is going to last forever. This is who I really am. I'm the only one who has ever suffered, you know, on and on. And they only make the painful experience that much worse. So mindfulness helps us clear them away. And we'll talk a lot more about that, too, as we talk about compassion. And then there are all of those neutral, ordinary, repetitive, routine experiences that come our way, for sure, where we tend to go to sleep and numb out and be cut off and so on. And that is a time when mindfulness can help us actually wake up and be alive and not just count on intensity to help us feel alive, but the depth and subtlety of our own awareness and connection can provide that. So, mindfulness is a way of relating to everything, painful, pleasant, everything in between, a way that's different, a relationship that's different. And then the third great skill of meditation after concentration and mindfulness is loving kindness or compassion itself. And this is developed in many ways, and we're going to play with that, you know, a lot of these different ways throughout today and tomorrow as well. The very notion of compassion as a skill I find a little startling often in the West. It's not maybe, I don't know, it sounds cold or mechanistic to us. Yeah, like I'm going to develop compassion, like, I know, it's interesting. I have many times been in some place where a scientist, especially a neuroscientist, is doing a presentation for the Dalai Lama of their research. And while a tremendous amount of energy and research went and is still going into looking at mindfulness in lots of different ways, there is an emerging movement looking at compassion meditation. And so very often at the end of one of these presentations, the scientists will say as their concluding comment, "And from these findings, Your Holiness," speaking to the Dalai Lama, "from these findings, Your Holiness, we might even begin to start thinking of compassion as a skill." And I always sit there and I think, well, duh. You know? But it's true. It's like a pronouncement here in the West in general. It is like a pronouncement. It's a thing. So I look at that. I'm quite fascinated by that, actually. Why? Does it seem too cold? Does it seem too mechanical to us? Is it that we tend to think of compassion as a gift? And it's like some people have it and other people don't. And if you don't, you're out of luck. Is it that we tend to think of compassion as a kind of immediate emotional response, reaction, and just happens or doesn't? There's no way to cultivate the ground. There's no way to set the stage. Whereas in Buddhist psychology or Eastern psychology, you could even say, compassion is very, very much seen as a skill. We have the capacity, every single one of us. We can train our attention, because a lot of it is about attention training and emotional regulation, you would say. We can train our attention to cultivate the ground so that compassion more and more and more will emerge as an emergent property. Absolutely, any one of us can. It's not through faking it, it's not through trying to pretend we feel something we're not actually feeling. It is by shifting how we pay attention. Do we see, for example, when we look at our own fear, craving, and jealousy, do we call those bad and wrong and terrible? Do we see ourselves as bad people? Or can we shift attention and recognize these are states of suffering? These are states of some considerable pain. When you see how much we or others are willing to give up and compromise and sacrifice to get something we crave, that's a state of suffering. When you see how narrow our view can get when we're filled with fear. So I'm not talking about feeling something. I'm talking about being really overwhelmed by it, and then when it's a powerful force in our lives, that's not pleasant, you know. That's really painful. It's not bad. It's not evil. It's not wrong. It's so painful. That's a shift in attention, but it's a shift that's also encompassing something that's true. It's not like we're saying, like, gotta, you know, be happy, or at least pretend, or, you know, I spent a day or 2 days, which is even worse, talking about and thinking about and meditating on compassion, and I really can't stand talking to this person, you know, Sunday night. It's like so boring and, you know, it's awful, but after all, 2 days, I better act like I care. You know, it's not like that. Our whole sense of who we are and where happiness is to be found and what connection means and where strength is and all of that shifts as we pay careful attention. We learn something about happiness and connection and all those things, and so we're different. So compassion is really like a skill that we can definitely develop, and that's primarily, it's going to be that would be what we gather around in these next couple of days. So why don't you take some kind of break, and then we'll come back and we'll start with the sitting. I figured you might like to stretch or even get up. It looks like it's not raining yet.